Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent are Generals Dan Greenfield. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
And Sean Myers.
At ease, Kelly.
How are you doing, guys? Thank you both for being here.
Thanks so much.
Sean and I covered part one, and so we're happy to have Dan aboard, one of our regulars, for part two. In case anybody doesn't know, we're talking about Comrades in Arms, part two. As I mentioned, it aired on December 13th, 1977. Now, before I get to the plot synopsis of this one, Dan, I just want to get your general feeling about part one. What do you know, in terms of that episode, how do you feel about it as we're heading into the conclusion of it?
Well, the two parts, it's a landmark two part. And I kind of judge it on that level as opposed to just being a routine MASH episode. So I kind of look at it from that perspective. In rewatching them in preparation for this, I think that in a lot of ways, the first episode is stronger than the second episode. But I on the whole, I think it's great. I definitely, as you commented in the last episode, see the cracks and see where, from a writing standpoint, there were definitely some things that are forced to make what happens happen. But I do think that they sell it well, particularly given the history of these characters. But I think on the whole, it's a really good episode with some drawbacks, but I still can't get past the fact that it's one of the landmark episodes of the series. So I always give it a certain level of respect, and I have a certain level of admiration for it, because I think what they did here overall is important for both characters.
That is absolutely true. Let's get into the plot synopsis for this one, then we'll dig right into the events of Comrades in Arms Part 2. It was written by Alan Alda and directed by Alan Alda and Burt Metcalf. The morning after the night before, Hawkeye and Margaret wake up in their beat-up tent. Hawkeye's a little nervous, made worse when he sees that Margaret seems to think this is the beginning of a long-term relationship and the natural evolution of their time together at the 477th. She even reveals deep down that she would laugh sometimes when Hawkeye would get in a real good one off on Frank. A wounded North Korean soldier arrives in the hut, but they can't leave because Hawkeye's wounded leg has stiffened up overnight. They hide under some debris long enough for the soldier to stagger in, look around, and fall over. He's seriously wounded and was using his last few moments of consciousness to scrounge for food. He passes out. As Hawkeye works on him, Margaret hears a chopper outside. She runs outside and sees one of theirs, a chopper flown by the pilot named Aylesworth, with BJ as a passenger. She tries to flag them down, but they don't see her. They do see Hawkeye and Margaret's lost Jeep. But when they get shot at by the Jeep's North Korean thieves, they head back to the 477th. When they arrive, Potter is furious that they went up without permission, but he's mollified when BJ tells him he thinks they saw where Hawkeye and Margaret might be. Potter says that now the 863rd is back where it's supposed to be, they can finally send out a search party. Another day passes, and Hawkeye and Margaret are stuck sitting under one parka as rain pours down on them, reading a map by flashlight. They're discovered by a member of the 863rd, which overjoys Hawkeye, leaving Margaret furious now that it's dawned on her that Hawkeye isn't interested in having a relationship with her. Back at the 863rd, they perform the surgery they were sent there for. The surgery goes well, but the tension is thick when it's obvious to everyone in the room that these two visitors aren't getting along. You can hear the painful slap of the instruments as Margaret thrusts them into Hawkeye's hand. At the 477th, BJ, Potter, Winchester, and Father Mulcahy have a drink to celebrate the imminent return of Hawkeye and Margaret. They wonder at how difficult it must have been for the two of them since they're so different. But it's Father Mulcahy, via some innocently intended comments, that puts the idea in everyone's heads that maybe they turn to each other for comfort. A few hours later, Hawkeye and Margaret do return home to a party in their honor. After receiving some gifts, Hawkeye profusely thanks everyone for really saving his skin, so profusely that a boiling Margaret slaps him across the face and storms out. Later that night, Hawkeye visits Margaret in her tent to talk. At first, she completely denies anything happened, but then she softens a bit and owns up to what did happen, but in terms so stiff, Hawkeye says that he'll have a lawyer draw up a contract. Margaret gets the point and levels with Hawkeye by reading him a letter she's accidentally sending to Donald Penobscot, thanking a non-existent Hank for an amazing, tender night in that abandoned hut. Hawkeye and Margaret own up to the idea that nothing more will come of this since they're so different, but they both admit that they shared something together and their relationship as friends will be different, better from now on. So, all right, that is Comrades in Arms Part 2. Sean, what's your overall impression of this episode as a conclusion to what's just been set up in Part 1?
Overall, I do like this episode much better than the first one. Just because I think like it's all the aftermath of the night before, all of that. And it does like kind of like course correct itself. You know, it's not going to be some big love affair. Generally, like the two characters aren't going to be that different. Like I have some nitpicky things and possibly a no prize to help me get through one thing I kind of hate. But for the rest of it, I do like this one a lot better than the first one.
I like the first one better than the second one. Really for me, it's more interesting for me to watch this, not from Hawkeye's perspective, but from Margaret's, because this is really the turning point in the season for her in a lot of ways. I've long said that season six is all about the redemption of Margaret Houlihan. I mean, they got her married to Donald Penobscot with the idea that they were going to have them divorce. Obviously, this is a major turning point in that entire, you know, story arc and character arc. We see sides of Margaret that we rarely have seen in the past. But at the same time, I think it does come off as a little clunky and a little one-dimensional. I think that the writer, well, I guess it was Alan Alda, I think there was still this knee-jerk return of, you know, nasty Margaret, and I think that the overcompensating by her being so incredibly sweet, like to the point where it's like really cringy. I'm not actually sure that would have been Margaret's reaction, but mm-hmm. given the way the story plays out, I can sort of see it, because we are seeing her vulnerable, and you know, it sort of comes back to it whenever they showed her tent, and they make the point here is that they show them in the tent at the end, and they're sitting, and you forget that Margaret's got all these things hanging up in her tent that are not military issue. They're almost like souvenirs that, you know, a girl has from her travels, or a boy would have. There's something very childlike about what she's got hanging up for the most part, that you kind of remember that she's also, you know, for all of her hard-bittenness, there's a lot of vulnerability here. And I think there's some, I don't think it always comes off through this episode. And I think at times the episode is unfair to Margaret, but on the whole, I think it's very, very important for her overall arc as a character, not just for this season, but from the beginning of the series to the end.
Yeah, that is my only issue with this episode, is that it seems Margaret gets so clingy so fast, and I just wouldn't buy that Margaret would do that. That she would turn to Hawkeye in this moment, which again Sean and I covered in part one, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that she would immediately be like, well, now we're together. I just don't think Margaret would ever look at Hawkeye that way. I mean, it's written by Alan Alda. You can't possibly impugn his experience right. in this show.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's kind of like how I felt like about the Fallen Idol episode, which was also written by Alan Alda. I was just like, would this character act this way? Okay. I mean, if Alan Alda says so, then that's the ultimate authority. But I don't know. It just, every time I watch it, I just go, would she turn that hard on in that direction? I don't know.
That's what I was alluding to with No Prize. I absolutely agree. Like, we know that in the past, Margaret has had relations with generals and the upper ranks. Absolutely. Like, it's been established. Like, she, I don't think this is going to be vulgar to say. Like, I think she is fine to have sex for pleasure. Like, I think that's fine. Like, that's, you know, no shaming with that at all whatsoever. I think maybe the difference is, I think now that she's married to Donald, she has like that in her mindset. Donald's the man I'm going to stay with. I'm going to love him. That rug has been swept out from under. Now there is someone who she, at the very least, she respects him as a doctor. Like, you know, he's faultless in his medical profession. And as in images with the puppy, like she has opened up to him a little bit. So my no prize is, you know, she's so hurt by Donald and, you know, shaken up by that, that this is, you know, a man who shows her, you know, affection and does think she's beautiful. So now she's all in on that. Now, I do kind of agree. I don't know that she really would go all in on that, but maybe that's why she's acting that way. Maybe.
I don't think it's a no prize, Sean. I actually think that that's the heart of what's going on with Margaret here is, frankly, she's traumatized. You know, I mean, not only did she just find out, not just that her husband had cheated on her, but that he looks at this other woman in a completely different way than he looks at his own wife.
Yeah.
And she is feeling the pain of that, the clickety click click stuff, you know, the fact that she's always shown to be tough as nails. And I think in this particular case, you put in the fact that they're terrified. You put in the fact that they've both been drinking, and you put in the fact that she's already emotionally devastated. I think that her reaction to this, I think that explains why she behaves the way she does the morning after. Now, I grant you the idea of her being like a couple with Hawkeye is taking it a little far, but I can sort of see her being all lovey-dovey in the morning because she's not herself. She's gone through a hell of an experience here, and she so desperately wants to be loved and admired as a woman and not as a nurse and not as an officer that I think that catches up with her in this particular circumstance. Her own anger and her own personality, obviously, she can't get too far away from. But I think what appears to be out of character in a way can be explained. But I agree, it does feel a little forced.
Rewatching this episode, part one and part two, obviously, for purposes of this podcast, kind of like what I said about Fallen Auto, I liked them a lot more than I remembered. The stuff that I really liked, I really liked. And the stuff that bothered me, which was the relationship stuff, I was like, well, all right. But it's okay. It goes by, especially this one. That stuff goes by kind of quickly, again, which we'll talk about. So, the episode opens in OR, and we see that obviously our doctors are incredibly busy because they don't have Hawkeye and they don't have Margaret. So that's kind of a big deal. There is right out of the gate, there was one of my favorite moments from this episode where Potter tells Winchester, you know, basically we're falling behind, shake a leg. And Winchester says, when I'm done, I'm done. And Potter says, I'm sorry I asked. And then Winchester mutters, that's what I had in mind. But then they cut and you see that Potter heard that.
Yeah.
I love that detail. I love that Potter is like, like, okay, I'm going to deal with this later. But I love Winchester knows he can't say it too loud because Potter's the commander, but I love that he doesn't do it quietly enough that Potter doesn't hear it. I just love that bit. So I feel like Winchester got put on night shifts for months after this. Yeah, I just love it. And I also love, by the way, Mulcahy is basically acting as the nurse, which, yeah. Is that medically sound? I know things are looser all the way in Wijongbu, South Korea, but I think
it's really analogous to when Radar and Father Mulcahy are out and they have to do the tracheotomy. Like, you know, you have to, you know, we're down someone, you're going to have to pitch in. And I think it is stuff that, like, can be told, like, you know, hold this open. Like, he's not going to be sewing someone open, but, like,
that's true.
Like, you can suction out stuff and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I guess so.
Just by being there, you know, and I mean, what he's picked up, or what all of them have picked up, those who were not medical professionals, just by being there and being a part of this asylum, you know that he's been, you know, he's picked up some things and he can do the basics just in the same way. You know, I mean, we've seen other people who are not doctors or nurses assist in this way. Is this the first time we've seen Mulcahy do this? Because I thought we'd seen that before, but I could be misremembering that too.
In the There Is Nothing Like a Nurse, where the nurses get shipped out because they're afraid of the attack, which of course ends up being 5 o'clock Charlie. They even have like Igor helping out. I mean, good lord, yeah. Igor can do it. Yeah,
exactly. I Father Mulcahy, yeah, might as well be a graduate of Harvard Medical School.
I feel like having Igor helping you in surgery is totes off the books. Like that was not written down anywhere. They're just like, all right, it's fine. Yeah, okay. For all we know, that they do training classes, you know, for everybody who's not a member of the medical staff, you know, that would make sense to do. So we have Winchester talking about Pierce and Margaret, and he keeps using them in the past tense. Hawkeye was a good surgeon, and Margaret was a great nurse. And of course, we mentioned this in part one. One of the kind of repeating bits through this two-parter is how pissed BJ is. BJ is normally the most good-natured kind of character. But here he is just every scene, his eyes are bulging. Mike Farrell's eyes are kind of like bulging out like that because he just cannot tolerate this idea that his best friend is up there, maybe dead or wounded. So I love that it runs through these two parts, that this is BJ is just not having any time for any sort of doom scrolling when it comes to talking about his friend and Margaret.
And Rob, I want to just tell you, I think as soon as I say it, you'll remember it. This totally reminds me of the scene in Justice League of America 193, where Aquaman is, I guess, frozen.
He yells at Firestorm. And Wonder Woman yells at Firestorm.
Firestorm because, like, he Firestorm is talking about Aquaman. Like, there's no way he could have survived that, man.
He must be dead. Yeah,
that's exactly right. I thought about.
That's fantastic. That's one of my favorite moments from Justice League. Yeah. And Flash is like, you know, stop being an idiot, Firestorm. Yeah. So, oh man, good callback, John. I appreciate that. But I think that's great. It's a great little bit for BJ, you know, that he gets to kind of be the more serious one here where he's like, stop talking about them like this, you know? And yeah, it's deeply offensive already sort of acting like they're gone. So then we cut to the morning after. Margaret is laying on Hawkeye's chest, and we see this great look on Alan Alda's face where he's like, what? Oh, yeah, that. okay. It's nice for them to have put all their clothes back on, I guess. Okay, you know, whatever. But Margaret wakes up, and she's, you know, very sweet. She's like, did you sleep well? And she gets some food. And so, again, this is what we talked about. You know, it feels a little weird to me. I guess maybe weird to me that I'm just not used to seeing Margaret like this with anybody. You know, obviously she has that side to her. You were just talking about, Dan, that she has all the accoutrement of a regular person in her tent, and she loves children. We've established that she loves animals. She has that side to her. So this is that side of it. It's just, we just never get to see it.
But it's also of its time. I mean, we're seeing Margaret playing house. Is really what this is. And that's why I also think that, and just to go back to a point that you both raised in the last episode, it is an awfully unsexy place for this to all to have happened. and it does stretch credibility to a degree that this would go that far. Maybe kissing or whatever, I can see that, but it really doesn't lend itself to being sustained, as it were.
I can't have music playing because it throws me off. Much like bombs.
We're learning a lot about Sean in this episode. Wow. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, kids, see what he means by that is no. But I think that's part and parcel of what Alan Alda was trying to show. I do think that if the episode were written today. It might have been done differently. Mm-hmm. So, and because of the nature of it being, you know, everything has to be resolved and they've got to go back to the status quo, only not by the end of the episode, that we're getting to see that side of Margaret simply because it's a reflection of she's trying to be all the things that she's feeling vulnerable about. That her own husband doesn't seem to recognize.
Yeah.
So I do think that that's the psychology here of her basically overcompensating. And it is very cringy to see her like this. This just doesn't feel like the Margaret we know. And while it may be somewhat of a stretch for her to behave this way, it also is in character because she, this is a part of her that this vulnerable, quote unquote, old school wifely, character that she's kind of playing at here, I think is coming out simply because she, I go back to the fact that I think that she's traumatized. And I think that that's part of what's happened here is that she's just simply so desperate to be seen this way that she's behaving in that way. Now, maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe this wasn't, maybe just sometimes a scar is a scar, but it does feel to me that that's sort of the, it's why I can sort of accept her behavior, even though it does seem out of character and is definitely cringy at the very least.
We have established too that Margaret wants this life. She wants a domestic existence. She went back when she talks about her sister, and her sister married somebody that Margaret dumped, and now that she has a big house, I would have loved to have known all that kind of stuff. And she wanted that life from Frank, and he was not, of course, capable to deliver that. And so that makes it. Yeah, she's creating it in a microcosm here in this awful setting. Sean and I did talk about that a little bit in part one. We didn't get too far into it because I don't want an NSFW tag on MASHcast, but it really did seem like we really, like, in a dirty hut where anybody, like a Russian soldier, could come in and shoot you, this is where you're going to, like, actually have sex. Like okay, not, again, not kink shaming anybody, but it just, that would not work for me in any respect. But okay, whatever. So,
well, it's more dramatic than them going to a weekend in Tokyo and having too much to drink and just
Exactly. So they, Margaret and Hawkeye start talking, and Margaret talks about, she mentions that she loves his humor and the fact that someone once in a while, he would get a joke right off on Frank, a really good one, and she would be grinning ear to ear, and Hawkeye's like, oh, no kidding and stuff. And anyone who's watching MASH at this point had some familiarity with the show, I would bet. I think, probably they weren't adding a lot. Well, actually, by the second half of MASH's run, it was more popular than it ever had been. So maybe it did gain viewers. I appreciate the fact that the show, and in this case, Alan Alda writing it, doesn't go out of his way to mention who Frank is. It's just, you have to know, oh, Frank is Frank Burns. I like that. Because, a lot of other shows would do that. It happened in the first episode with the Dr. Borelli thing, where they just mentioned Dr. Borelli. They don't say, oh, it's because back in season three, so I just like that Frank is this sort of specter that's hanging over the show a little bit. I mean, after season six, I think they mention him twice more in like the remaining five seasons of the show. But he gets mentioned. I mean, obviously he's just recently gone, but I love that. I love that this sort of revisionist history that Margaret's like, oh yeah, once in a while. Yeah. I liked it. Cause you really tore Frank a new one in front of everybody.
Right. The other thing was, I think it was, I want to say this was in episode or season four, where I think BJ and Radar are talking, and Radar's trying to get a handle on Margaret and Frank and their relationship. And I think it's BJ who says, you're dealing with two broken people.
Yes, it is BJ. Yep.
And I think that that's still the Margaret we're talking about. I think that the Margaret of season 10 would not have reacted the way she does here.
Yeah.
But because of where we were with the character and where we'd seen her development, which really started in bits and pieces early on, that they kind of flirted with the idea that she had more depth with than Frank. And then they really hammered that home, before they got to this season. And this season is obviously makes it abundantly clear that, she never should have been interested in him in the first place. But I do think that the character that she becomes would have handled this in a much different way than where she was at this point in her evolution as a character. And that is, I know that's weird, and it's like I'm looking at her like she's a real person, but it does track with the way she has developed over 11 seasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you spend this much time with the character, they feel like real people, that's why you care about it. It makes total sense. I love that she's making the jam on the crackers, and when she mentions to Hawkeye, if only I had known about this before Donald. And then she shoves the cracker in his mouth, and he's so stunned that the cracker just kind of just goes in and he's like, eh? it's a great little gag. And then she has this bit where she's like, oh my God, I must look horrible. And he's like, what do you mean? You look fine. She's like, I don't have lipstick. I don't have a comb. My teeth. Oh my God. My teeth must be so positively dim. And Hawkeye has a great line. Margaret, you could read by your teeth. Which is, that's a great, I just love that line. Like, okay. Yeah. Margaret does have really quite nice teeth. So like Hawkeye and you could see why, especially as we were just talking about, like, she's been dealt a series of hammer blows from her husband that she is responding to Hawkeye because he's being nice to her. You know, he says how nice she looks. You know, he's like, my God, you look fantastic and everything else. So, yeah, you know, I mean, he's kind of desperate for compliments. He's like, I always thought you were, you know, I just thought you were an interesting person. You know, like he's kind of dead. He doesn't want to say too much. But I mean, this is a nice bit, but you really do feel bad for Margaret here because it's rough.
She's scrambling. She's emotionally scrambling.
So we go back to the 477th and BJ is talking to a chopper pilot and the aforementioned Aylesworth, who I mentioned, he is played by the actor named Douglas Rowe. He was in shows like Melrose Place, Murder, She Wrote, Gilmore Girls, Room 222. This is one of those characters that we will never see again, but supposedly is good friends with everybody here at the 477th because they seem to know each other quite well. BJ makes this great sales pitch, you know, about, well, you know, it's just the North Koreans. What's the problem? And, you know, we're not going to, and he says the North Koreans might find them and we're not going to let that happen. We're not. No, we're not. And so again, it's going back to the thing of BJ is, this is very un-BJ like behavior to kind of like counterman what Potter told him to do, but this is how much he cares about it. So I dig this scene a lot. I wish they had maybe the same two or three actors play the chopper pilots just for the sake of continuity. But as we know, MASH did care about that. So fine. Aylesworth, the chopper pilot.
I have to tell you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Go ahead, Dan.
No, I had the same reaction about Aylesworth too. I was like, man, I wish this was a regular character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish that was part of the show so that I think that it would not only would this scene have had more weight, but the scene, you know, jumping ahead in the tent when they get back and he and BJ are doing the duet, mm-hmm. you know, serenading them. It feels weird because here's a guy that we've never seen before, but they're in perfect sync. So, I mean, it was interesting. I was like, man, they should have brought this guy back. But yeah, you know, aside from the fact that we just kind of have to look past that. What I also like about what BJ's doing here, and he makes the point, and he knows Potter well enough by this point that he knows that they're going to defy orders, but he also knows that if they're successful, they're going to get away with it. So he's definitely gone out on a limb for BJ for sure, but he also knows that this is a risk worth taking. You know, and then what's the worst that can happen? He knows Potter's not going to throw him in the stockade,
right?
And I have to say, I have the exact same feeling as Dan, but for an exact opposite reason, because Aylesworth is a pilot. He has the leather jacket with the wool. He has the mustache. He has musical ability. He talks about butts and slings. I have fallen for Aylesworth.
You're on board. You're all in on Aylesworth.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I agree. I would have been cool if they had a recurring chopper pilot character. That would have been kind of neat to do that. Once, you know,
and it would have made sense for in the context of the show too, given mm-hmm. how many times that they went to that well. You know, they had Robert Hogan played him, you know, mm-hmm. One of them in an episode. And, yeah, I mean, it would have been good if there had been that little bit of continuity, but what are you going to do? You know, it is what it is. They needed it for the plot. And I give Alan all the credit and the actor credit, because I think not only does he pull it off with the performance, but the way he's written, they just make it very natural. We know because we're MASH addicts how weird this is. But it does, if you're just watching it, it does flow well. And I think that they have an instant rapport, BJ and Aylesworth.
So we're back to the hut, and Hawkeye and Margaret are cleaning up on the leftovers and stuff. and they hear some rustling outside, and they see that it's a North Korean soldier. Hawkeye is, of course, still wounded. He's got that supposedly giant hunk of wood that had just been pulled out of his leg, and he's looking out the window, and Margaret lets loose, "It's all right. Don't panic, darling. We'll be all right." And Hawkeye is North Korean, "Darling." Which
well, and even better, he starts to talk and then stops and then says, "Yeah, darling." I think that's what makes it even better.
That's a great. That's the perfect timing of "darling." Like, he's in the middle. They really are worried that, like, you know, they're gonna get shot, and yet he has that moment of like, "What? You know, like, what? Okay." So the North Korean soldier is played by an actor named James Saito. He has like a couple of hundred credits. He's still working today. He has a bunch of MASH credits. He was the platoon leader in 5 o'clock Charlie. He's one of the guys that that Frank is giving the coordinates to, you know, 1-17 and stuff like that. And then they shoot at 5 o'clock Charlie. So he wanders in, he finds some food. He sees that obviously there's this sort of strange lump under this kind of like rug, not a rug, but kind of like blanket sort of thing. But then he collapses over. He falls over, and Hawkeye examines him. And Alda has just such a great line read where he's like, you know, he's only got a couple hours left. What kind of crazy place is this? How hungry can they be? And I, you know, the Hawkeye's genuinely aghast at this, that someone would, you know, risk all this when they are probably dying. But he's also coming from, you know, the nice warm confines of Crabapple Cove. And so he's, you know, he's been here a couple of years, as we know, but I just love that that is still something that bothers him or just it gobsmacks him. He's just like, my God, what kind of situation am I finding myself in that someone who is on death's door would be worried about, you know, getting a lump of food just before they die? What good does it do you? So Margaret hears a chopper. She looks outside. She says, it's one of ours. We cut and see that that is, in fact, BJ and Aylesworth, but he can't see Margaret. They're a little too far away. Potter, of course, has caught wind of this, and Klinger is operating the radio because radar is not in this episode. And then BJ sees that, oh, I think we've seen their Jeep. And we see the four North Korean soldiers notice, and they pull out their guns and they start firing and shooting off at BJ and Aylesworth, who they have to take off.
I have a super geeky question that maybe you don't know the answer to. When they are firing the guns, is that a practical? Because you see, like, you almost see like sparks or whatever.
You see like a muzzle flash. Yeah.
Is that a practical effect, or did they go in and add that?
That's a great. It seems
because
hard.
It kind of looks fake that it was put in post. But then I'm like, could they do that back then?
They certainly could. They had the technology, you know. By the fact that it's the actors are outside, like that's an outside shot. They're not on the 20th Century Fox lot. They're out in location. Mm-hmm. I'm betting that those are blanks that they are actually firing. They're getting the muzzle fire.
Okay.
That makes sense to you, Dan?
Yeah, that's what I
think. Yeah, I figured. And so Margaret comes in to grab Hawkeye. And of course, Hawkeye is like, where's the sulfa? You know, he's worried about this patient. And Margaret Margaret calls him darling again. He says, there are people out here who want to kill us. And Hawkeye is not really paying attention. He says, I want to take him with us. She says, he's the enemy. He says, that's funny. He bleeds just like our side. So yeah, these two are never going to get along. There's this great bit about where she's like, look, I love how brave you are. It's thrilling, really. I love seeing a strong man who takes charge like this. Now do what I tell you. Walk to that door. And she has this great bit where Hawkeye says, well, maybe they won't come in here. And she's like, he came in here. We came in here. It's like Grand Central Station in here. This is a great bit. I love that. And, you know, and then they finally decide, look, they have to leave him behind. Because they just can't, risk it. And it's very anti-Hawkeye to do, but I guess in this situation, like they have no other choice. He's barely able to walk. This guy is completely unconscious. There's no way that it can carry him. So it seems a little atypical of Hawkeye, but this is a crisis moment.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. I also think that, again, this is a case where later series, Margaret would have would have also felt a need to do what they mm-hmm. could for him and wouldn't just dismiss him as the enemy. Mm-hmm. I think this also shows where she was as a character at this point in the series. But yeah, in this one, if you stay, you are going to die most likely. So if your choice is you have to leave and you're going to leave someone behind who is likely not to make it. I mean, Margaret's actually right, as much as it rubs Hawkeye the wrong way in terms of his, not just the Hippocratic Oath, but his personal ethics.
Right, right. There's no way they can't do it. They just can't do it. That's the end of our act break. And then we come back and BJ and Aylesworth land. And Potter immediately starts to yell at BJ, but then BJ cuts him off and says, I think we found him. And then Potter immediately turns on a dime and he's like, oh, okay. And he literally, he gets in the Jeep and he's driving down there. Yeah. So yeah, Potter is results oriented. Let's say, that's what he wants to do. So they head back to the camp to find out what's going on. So we find Margaret and Hawkeye and it's night and they're getting rained on. They're looking at a map with a flashlight. I'm guessing are those maps like waterproof or something? Because I would imagine that.
I think it was plastic coated.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Okay.
It looked like to me. That's what it looked like to me.
Okay. So Margaret is kind of doing lovey-dovey again, and she talks about his Hawaiian shirt. She's like, I like it, it's nice, but I hate it. She's immediately starting to kind of like change him a little bit, and he's not really interested in all that. She's like, what are we going to tell Donald? And Hawkeye says, well, what do you usually tell him? Which catastrophically wrong thing to say.
It's a great line. It's a really great line. But yeah, the entire episode and everything turns right then and there.
What do you mean? What I normally tell him?
Rubicon.
Yeah, this absolutely. I think with anyone who's been in a relationship, once in a while, you had that moment where you've said something and you go, "Oh no, why did I? Why did I just?" I don't think I've ever said anything that catastrophically bad, but close, So.
The laughs of recognition.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you're just like, mm-hmm. Yeah. See, now that was a line that as a kid didn't really register with me. As an adult, oh yeah, I've had some experience under my belt. So they hear some footsteps and they're worried that it's an enemy soldier, but we see that it's not. It's a member of the 863rd. It's an actor, the squad leader, as he's credited. This actor's name is Leland Sun. He is in, he's been in a bunch of MASHes. He goes all the way back to an appearance in Chief Surgeon Who in season one. Wow. And then his last appearance is in A Holy Mess in season 10. So he ran the kind of the gamut on MASH. He was on other shows like Night Court, Cheers, Heart to Heart, and he has a credit on IMDb as Man on Toilet in Hamburger the Motion Picture, which is Hollywood can be a rough, rough time, rough gig sometimes. So, but that's Leland Sun, and he finds it. By the way, the set that they built for this rain sequence is really good. Like, mm-hmm. It looks like I know MASH had a decent budget. It was a hit show by this point, but this is still a TV budget. This looks really good. The rain is pouring on them. It's not just a light spritz. It is a downpour. We see them run around a bit. So it's more than just like a couple of inches square around. Like I almost wonder, like, did they use this for other shows or other movies? It seems too good to just build it and then destroy it when you don't need it again.
And I don't know if it's because like everything's wet, but when you watch it on Hulu, that scene looks like it was shot in HD.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me also, Rob, that you say that, you talk about it being a set build. It totally works as an illusion to me because you pointed that out, but it never occurred to me that that was an indoor set.
Oh, really? Yeah, no, it was.
I always just assumed it was shot outside at night, but of course they didn't do that, so it wouldn't. It couldn't have been. I'm sure that it was, like you say, that it was done inside.
Yeah, it looks terrific. It looks really, really good, And, the show obviously can budget things here and there. Like the episode following this, The Merchant of Korea, is like a bottle episode, you know, like that's a very minimal episode. It's going to just feature our main cast members. It's going to use standing sets. This one, this two-parter, I mean, obviously it's a two-parter, but it's ambitious. It's a lot of new sets. You know, we're seeing the 863rd.
Yep.
We're seeing them stuck outside. We're seeing this hut. We have, you know, original shots of a helicopter, you know, like new footage of them in a helicopter. Like, there's a lot, and there's a lot of guest actors, you know, so like they obviously were like, you know, budgeting wise, they're like, okay, yeah, we're really going to spend some money on this one. So Hawkeye is, of course, really happy that he's been discovered. He's a little too happy. Margaret notices that they go to the 863rd and they perform this surgery, this vascular surgery that they were talking about. Margaret mentions the use of this clamp, which does not exist yet, because that's from a later episode.
Oh, is that what happened? Because I remember the episode that they had to build, you know, they had to create the clamp.
Patent 4077. Oh, that's the episode that builds the clamp, but that episode hasn't aired yet, so.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Well, you know, I've said, I think they jumbled season six around a little bit. I don't know whether this was the network or, you know, the producers themselves decided to rejigger things and have this two-parter at this point. And I mean, it's only because I'm a giant nerd and I've watched this so many times I even paid attention to it. But Margaret specifically mentions the clamp. Like, she goes out of her way to mention the clamp. So they have this surgery. And one of the things I noticed just again from watching this show so many times is we are presumably in the OR of the 8063rd, but they're in like a tent. Like, we can see it behind their heads. It's a tent. And I'm sure it's just a repurposed set from the 477 standing sets. But in a lot of ways, this kind of reminds me of the look of the MASH movie more than the show. When they operated in the MASH movie, they were in like just a big tent. They weren't in like a corrugated metal building the way the 477 is. But to me, it looks, these scenes with all these doctors behind them, by the way, they look like there's about 10 doctors surrounding them. By the way, the 863rd has a lot more staff than the 477 does. But, and then the partition separating them is just like a blanket.
Yeah.
So it's just much more informal. And so again, it reminds me a little bit more of the MASH movie. So Margaret is dropping these, you know, passive aggressive comments about, she slaps the clamp into his hand. It's a great, you hear like the, you know, you can hear it hit his hand and he's like, oh, thank you. And she says, you know, nurses, make sure you give the doctor everything he needs. Even if you don't think he can handle it, you got to give it to him, you know, or he'll turn on you viciously. And you see the doctors are all like, what's happening? What's going on? What's up with these two? And they go to the other side of the tent and they start having this screaming fight and they're acting like nobody can hear them.
That's one powerful curtain right there.
Yes. Yeah. I love how he says, you join me outside, and they just go right behind the tent and start screaming at each other. And it's like, everybody can hear you. Every single word. Yeah. No, it's a lot of shortcuts here.
There's a lot of goss going on at the 863rd about the crazy people over at the 477. But it's here where it all comes out, where she says, you know, what am I demanding, I suppose? And he says, he talks about how much he has to compliment her. And he says, look, I don't mind, but all this genuflecting is making my pants baggy, which is
that's
fantastic. That's a crusher, you know, by the way. And then she says, you know, don't worry, Buster, Sir Walter Raleigh, you ain't. You think you're not demanding. It isn't vain of me to laugh at every stupid thing that comes into your head. This is getting so mean. And she's like, and the sloppiness and the crudity. And of course, he's like, stop making me change who I am. Because of course, he's not interested in a relationship with her. So he doesn't care about these criticisms. He's not trying to land her. No. You know, he's moved on past this. But of course, Margaret sees it too. She realizes, oh yeah, no, this is not working. And they decide to, you know, they go back and then we cut back to the 477 and we see our four characters. By the way, the scene always cut in syndication. I never saw this scene until I got the DVDs where it's the four of them. And I don't know why Klinger isn't in the scene. I feel like he should be. I love that Winchester's in on it. I am totally pro Winchester being one of the guys. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's a small detail, but I love that they didn't leave him out. It warms the cockles of my cold dead heart to see him try to be one of the guys.
Well, I also like the fact that, you know, he's been driving them all crazy by acting like a selfish jerk.
Yes.
This entire episode, but yet he's still one of them, even though he's one of them right off the bat in his first season in a way that Frank never was.
Right.
And I know that that's been addressed and I know that that's been discussed. So I'm not going to get into that, you know, in any great detail, but yeah, it is just a slight little payoff to that. The fact that he's still there and he's still one of them, even if he doesn't want to be.
I mentioned, you know, this seems cut syndication. So when I used to watch this show and we get to the next scene and there's the big slap and stuff, and it's clear that BJ and Potter and Winchester, they're all in on that. Oh, they know what happened. Having not seen this scene, I was like, how did they jump to that conclusion?
Mm.
Like, how did they get there? Well, this scene is how they get there, because it's Mulcahy, ironically enough, it's Mulcahy is the one who is suggesting, oh, they, you know, they turn to each other in comfort and they're all starting to snigger a little bit. And of course, Mulcahy's like, oh, I think I'm in over my head here. Yeah. But that's how they get there. And so, you know, that's how the show works.
It's also the setup to one of my favorite Potter lines, which is "Hell hath no fury like a woman sustained," which I think is absolutely hysterical. But it doesn't make any sense whatsoever unless this scene is actually shown before it.
Exactly. Exactly. Again, thank you, anonymous Philadelphia syndicator who cut these shows to ribbons. So Hawkeye and Margaret arrive. There's a great little detail. BJ picks up Margaret and carries her all the way across the compound into the mess tent and then puts her on the table. I just think that's so sweet. You know, like he's that chummy with her at this point. I love all that stuff. So they have this little presentation for them, and they give them food. It looks like there's like, I don't know. Margaret looks like she has like a drumstick or it's something.
Chicken, yeah,
some is it like chicken? Okay, chicken. It is chicken.
Yeah, they're all eating chicken legs.
Okay, so they, I'm sure it's delicious. So Klinger gives them a compass made out of just paper. So we're saying that we don't get lost again. Mulcahy gives them these sort of passports that explain in case they ever get, treats them like children a little bit. If you ever get lost again, give them hot soup and, you know, don't do this or that, whatever. And then BJ and Aylesworth work up a whole song, which is okay. Like, when did they have time to work on this? You know, they're out there workshopping it, I guess. But okay, it's cute, you know.
They took it to Peoria first.
Well, I actually don't remember. I think it's after when the projector breaks down and they sing their song. The
movie tonight, yeah.
Yeah, but BJ and Aylesworth were doing a Wallace and Davis number. That was just for you, Rob.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Yeah. Hey up. Hey up. BJ and Aylesworth finish the song. Hawkeye and Margaret stand up and say thank you. And then Hawkeye starts thanking them all a little too much. You guys really saved my life. Oh boy, you really saved my life. And Margaret's retort is to slap Hawkeye across the face. Another thing I love this episode is when she wails on him, the splash he gets out of his beer is amazing. Like, it is like this, and it makes me wonder, how many takes did they do that? Did they have to get that? Because you could see that, like, he just drops it. It just wouldn't look as, but man, the beer, like, shoots across the mess tent from the sheer volume that she puts into it. She does a great job. And then that leads to the Potter line where he says, "Hell hath no fury like a woman sustained." So then we are back at the swamp, and Hawkeye and BJ have a heart to heart where they talk about what happened out there. And this is great. I love it. Yeah. It's an inversion of the scene from Hanky Panky where BJ turns to Hawkeye for advice. And so here Hawkeye has to consult BJ on this. I just think it's, I mean, look, I'm a sucker for any scenes of these two guys just being friends. Like, I wish there had been more of this, but I love it that they sit and they you know, she says, he says, I turned away first. I guess I've insulted her. I don't know what to do about it. And BJ's like, you know, you could talk to her, you know, think about that. And then he starts saying, well, maybe you felt something. And of course, Hawkeye's like, no, no, that's ridiculous. And BJ's like, maybe you did. And it scares you a little. So in some ways, BJ knows Hawkeye a little better than he knows himself. And so this is a terrific scene between these two actors. You know, it's heartfelt, it's smart, and it's warm, and I just love everything about it.
I like when BJ also says to Hawkeye, you know, he says, you can, you know, give a little bit, you can afford it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, you're really, it's a subtle way of saying you're not really the aggrieved party here. You know, you can be more charitable. She's obviously in a bad place. Mm-hmm. You can handle this without saying it. He basically says, come on, go be a man about it and go deal with it. But he does it in a very gentle, very brotherly way that is classic BJ. But I just love that line. You can afford it. And I thought to myself, I'm going to use that. I'm going to use that at some point. I don't know when I'll ever be in. I'm not going to be in Korea, so I don't know when the opportunity will arise. But I think it's a great line. Yeah. Well delivered.
Yeah, I mean, I've said multiple times across the episodes of the show, these guys' relationship was the thing, more than anything else, was the thing I hooked into as a kid, because it these were two characters who I deeply admired, and they could be smart and sensitive and be open to one another, and that was very informative to the young me, you know. And so when I have said, and I've said it to people in my life, I got to say it to Mike Farrell, for Pete's sakes, that you know, I would not be the person I am without the show. This is the stuff I'm talking about, because this is how influential it was stuff like that with these guys, that they could just be friends. They wouldn't, they just, because they were two guys, they didn't mean have to be knuckleheads, you know. And so it's just absolutely terrific. So Hawkeye goes to visit Margaret on BJ's advice, and of course initially Margaret is pretending nothing happened out there, not a thing. You know, and she's like, unless you took advantage of me while I was drunk.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. You know, it's like, oh boy. And then Hawkeye says, I was afraid I might like you too much, but now I don't have to worry. And he starts to leave. And then Margaret's like, okay, wait, hold on. Sit down. And they have this heart to heart. By the way, you mentioned, Dan, like all the stuff in Margaret's tent. I feel like they added more stuff for this scene or something. Like, I feel like there's like a million things in this scene.
It's very colorful.
She's got the red curtains.
Shown that before, but maybe again, it's also might be that across 11 seasons, I'm remembering the way it looked in later episodes. Maybe this is the first time they really did it up. I don't know. But I do remember her having a colorful tent compared to the others, actually. Mm. Whether this is the first time they really showed that or not, that I can't recall.
I feel like there's just more stuff. Like, we've seen some stuff, but this is like, she's got the red curtains and she's got the red fringe on her lamp or whatever. So yeah, it is very, very, it's very jovial. It's a very upbeat kind of place, and it's kind of atypical, and it's probably somewhat, you know, relatively unmilitary to have a place like this. But, you know, again, that's another dimension to Margaret's character. So they sit and they have this conversation. Initially, Margaret says, you know, I would agree to this. And Hawkeye has the line, fine, I'll have my lawyer draw up a contract. And this is something that they get at in a subtle way, where there's relationships you have with people. It's not necessarily just in a sexual context, but there are people in your life to where you have a connection with them so profound that you can't go back to the way it used to be if you tried to, you know, like once you've gotten to know this person, again, not strictly speaking in for their case, it's sexual, but not necessarily. But there are people in your life to where you've become close to them in a way that if you try and go back, it's awkward. You know, it's just awkward. And I've had that a little bit in my life, where there's been people that I used to be very close to, and then we fell out of each other's lives for different reasons. And then I saw them again, and it's just weird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just weird because you know so much about them. And, you know, and I think that they get at that here, because now these two obviously have a dynamic that you know, is completely different than anything we've expected, anything we've seen before. And Hawkeye talks about, you know, you're not leaving him. All he did was send you a letter, which is like all he did. It's actually pretty bad. And then, you know, he says the one he meant for you was just as nice, which again, he's really trying here. And Margaret has come up with this wonderful way of getting back at him, a carefully worded letter. And she says, "Dear Hank," which is a marvelously muscly guy name. You know, it's a great name. And then she says, "Maybe I should make it Dirk or Lance." They're all kind of manly names. And she reads this letter where she talks about the night in the abandoned hut and how much Hank was nice to her. And it's very, very sweet. And you gave me your warmth and caring when I was afraid. And Hawkeye just sits and listens to it. And then he finally says, you know, "Thank you, Darlene." It's a great way to wrap this up. I love it that they're calling each other by the these alt names. Just chef's kiss. Great way to end the episode.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think it's in a way the least forced of the encounters between the two of them throughout the two-parter. It really feels authentic, and I think it's earned by this time. But I also, and you're right, because from this point to the series, I mean, yeah, they bicker and fight and snipe at each other, but it's not with the same meanness and the nastiness that defined their relationship, especially in the first few seasons when she was, you know, kind of a one-note character. So it's this scene and what comes after that really makes me think of this two-parter as a turning point in the series and, you know, in general, and, you know, obviously Margaret's arc in particular.
Completely. And that's the end of the act break. And so then we come back and we're in the mess tent and we've got our surgical staff. Potter mentions that other units want to see this demonstration that supposedly went so well. By the way, fun fact, if you go to IMDb and you put in MASH, get the little graphic for any movie, it's this photo.
Oh, wow.
This is the photo they choose. Don't know why. I guess because it's got, you know, five of our main characters and you can see them all clearly. But yeah, this is the episode. It's the one they pick from. And it's kind of weird because it's like Winchester doesn't get it. Like he seems like he's not in on the bit, that he knows that they slept together. And it's like he knew it in the previous scene. So how could he, like, because they're all starting smiling. He's like, "Everybody stop smiling." Like, it's kind of weird that he doesn't understand it, which is like, he's an adult. He understands it.
Yeah.
And he mentions one moment of glory inside the operating room. And they have that nice little smile. And, you know, "What are you smiling at?" "Nothing." I love Potter. Well, first of all, they catch Hawkeye. "What are you smiling at?" He says, "Who's smiling? I'm not smiling." And then Margaret catches Potter. "What are you smiling at?" And he goes, "This isn't smiling. I'm serious." I love impish Potter. That's great. And then Winchester finally says, "All right, I'll do it. But there never be any more smiling." "Who's smiling?" And bang, that's the end of our episode. That's the end of Comrade in Arms Part 2. And like I said at the top of the show, I like this way more than I remembered liking it. So yay, MASHcast. I got to thank myself here for doing this. So this is a rough. I would say part one ends a little rough and part two opens a little rough, but everything around it, good.
I'll buy that.
Again, it's the two-parter right in the middle of the season. And as Dan said, Margaret and Hawkeye will never quite be the same again. He just can't be after all this. So, guys, favorite lines. Let me start with you, Sean. Do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
So I'm going to turn it around a little bit. You actually said my favorite line twice, and that's when Margaret says, and I love her reading of, "Yes, I could agree to that." And he says, "I have my lawyer drop it." I love that. But so since you said that twice, I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to tell you the line I hate the most in this episode. And that's when it's raining and they're, you know, under the parka, and it, like, after she talks about the shirt that she hates, Margaret says, "I'll have you in tow soon." Oh my God, I hate that. Like even in her mind, like, they're just together and now she's like changing stuff about it. Oh, like, what a horrible way to start a relationship. And certainly, you know, like when you meet someone, like maybe there are things that you don't like or whatever, but just to like think that I'm going to have you in tow soon. Oh my God. I hate that line.
I love you. You're perfect. Now change. You know? Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough. So I'm sorry if I mentioned it for you.
But no, I got to hear it twice.
That's there's great. So many great jokes in this episode. So Dan, what about you?
It's the one I've already mentioned. The hell hath no fury like a woman sustained. Yeah. I just think it's a very funny line. And you're right, Rob. I never really understood the line growing up. Like, what does that mean? I mean, it's obviously I know what he's talking about, but since when is that, you know, slang or jargon? But I always like the line. And then, yeah, it's the scene before it that sets it up and makes it a lot clearer.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. For me, I never do this, but I actually have two just because there was one scene I didn't mention, which I should have at the synopsis, was when in the OR, when BJ is getting on Winchester about referring to them in the past tense, and Winchester's kind of giving them an argument, and it's Mulcahy who says, you know, I'm going to, tonight, can we just kind of basically for tonight, we're going to pray for them. You know, we're going to kind of project some level of hope that they're still alive. And he says, is that too much to ask, Major? And Winchester says, touche, Father. Yeah. I love that. That's great. Yeah. Those two characters didn't get a lot of, you know, I mean, there's other actors in the scene, but they, Winchester and Mulcahy generally did not get a lot of one-on-ones together through the course of the show. And I, you know, we know that Winchester looks down on Hawkeye, certainly, and BJ and Klinger, maybe even Margaret to a certain extent, certainly Radar. He kind of looks down on Potter a little bit. You know, he kind of looks at him as like this kind of like, you know, he even calls him Colonel Cowpie in a later episode. And I like that he is willing to kind of be like, all right, okay, you know, you're right. I just like that he gives Mulcahy that respect. So that's a great bit. And again, I should have mentioned it earlier on. My favorite joke, though, is when they leave the soldier in the hut and Margaret is dragging Hawkeye away. And he says to the guy, you want to trade places, fella? that's great. Great. Alan Alda gave himself some funny lines. That's just a masterpiece of like, yeah, I'd rather be in a bombed out hut dying of a wound than be stuck with Margaret Houlihan at this point. So, so that is Comrades in Arms part two. Dan, you mentioned wanting to do this, like, you know, the past couple of seasons, you've been on our openers. Yeah. And then you mentioned really early on, you really wanted to be involved in Comrades in Arms, the two-parter. So thank you for being here. And Sean, thank you for being here. Thank you for coming back for doing part two with me. So thank you both.
You're awesome. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So, Sean, why don't you tell people, you know, you did it last episode, we'll do it again, where they can find you here on the network.
The first Wednesday of every month, Paul Keen and I host the Batman Family Reunion. We have so much fun. It's a great series, and it's especially golden now because it has entered the Dollar Comics phase. Woo! Love the Dollar Comics. Lots of stories. And we just really have a lot of fun. We have guests, and that's great. I just love it so much. The first Wednesday of every month is the Batman Family Reunion.
Absolutely. Check it out. Yeah, great show. Dan, what about you?
Great show. 13th Dimension, the website. That's 13thdimension.com. You can also follow us on Facebook. It's pretty much, the heart of the site is Silver and Bronze Age comic books and related popular culture. But, you know, we certainly, you know, do things that are of the moment and also even go farther back. But if you're into old school comics, check us out.
Absolutely. So of course you can find this show on our website, all the back episodes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can find the show on Twitter at MASH477cast. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various awards, one of which is to be name checked in the show of your choice. So big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Muscle Burbage, Dan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, Adam Ackerman, Lisa P, Laura Braun, Stefan Van Skyke, Michael Kelly, and Daryl Clark. Thank you so much for the support. So we will see you all next week. But until then, that is all.
Anybody from I-Corps sees us up there, there ain't going to be a sling big enough to hold our butts.
Say, Ellsworth, nobody's going to see us up there but the North Koreans. All they got is guns.